Hey everybody, welcome to the Rust is Gold Racing Podcast. We're back here at Rust is Gold Coffee Shop. I've got
Tyson Garcia.
Tyson Hollywood Garcia. We got a special guest here today. Somebody who's just an all-around fabricator, right, Tyson?
Yeah, this guy, Jake, he can fabricate anything. Pinstriper, painter, just all-around good guy. Father, yeah, does it all, man.
Down the way, not too far, an old-time rockabilly coffee bar. Wrecking machine tucked in the back, Elvis singing about a Cadillac. I'm on a BSA, been riding all day. Leather's on, goggles too, triumphing and knowing what you want to do. My boys are on Ducatis, happy now all the while. Yeah, these are rockers, it's their style. So let's ride, so let's ride.
How's it going, Jake? How you doing?
Very good. Happy to be here. My favorite hangout lately.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jacob's here every Sunday. Just about him and his kid Dylan, his boy.
Yeah, kind of even more than Sundays, right? I mean, I think I've seen you here the last, 3 days, something like that? Were you here Saturday?
Yeah, I stopped in Saturday to hook Jimmy up with some stickers. I do some vinyl stickers and stuff like that, and he needed some for his little guitar repair business here.
Yeah.
So I stopped in to see him for that, and then I was back Sunday pinstriping some stuff in front of people for the holiday pop-up show that we had, and here I am again.
Now, I gotta say, Jimmy was pumped. Did you see that? I showed you the two guitar bodies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Jimmy, yeah. If you're listening, we had to sneak down to your workshop and check those things. I had to show Steve, because I was really impressed with like the pinstriping and the color. And you did mostly airbrush, right?
One of them was all pinstriping. The other was pinstriping with some airbrush mixed in. We're talking about a couple of guitar bodies that I did for him, which I was excited to do because of my talents, music is not one of them at all. But I have always just loved musical instruments, and I have a lot of creative ideas about building some custom ones, and to have somebody that really knows what they're doing building guitars, having me contribute some of my paintwork to that was really exciting for me.
Yeah, we're talking about Jimmy Devaney and Percolator Guitar Repair, which is here in the collective.
Yeah, he was pumped, man. He was really excited. He brought those in. We were talking about it for a long time, and when he brought them in, we looked at him, and he was excited, man. He was really excited because he's trying to get into guitar building himself.
Yeah, custom guitar building.
Exactly. And he wanted to start. And what a good way to start, right, with some awesome bodies.
Yeah.
But the cool thing about Jake, too, is I think there's nothing he can't fabricate or see. You know, I would say out of my friends, you know, I have some artists out there, some artist buddies, but out of like a lot of my friends, I'd say Jake is truly an artist at what he does. Just being able to see, you know, he made a bench here one time that was super cool. He made a skeleton, like, skull statue, and he used all kinds of fab parts and gears and stuff like that. And just being able to see something and use it, you know, I haven't seen an artist like Jake in a while. So it's cool to see.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the beginning, man. How'd you get into this? Are you from New Mexico?
Yep. I grew up in the Knob Hill area, right here in Albuquerque. My mom was a special ed teacher here in town. Well, here in Moriarty and out in Bernalillo. And my dad was a ceramic artist. So we had a studio in my backyard from the time I was born. And that's pretty much where I grew up, was out in his studio.
And for people who don't know Albuquerque, Knob Hill is kind of like, that's the arty district. It's near the college, and most of the people that live there are like architects and artists and college students. So really, it's like a trendy area. So did it feel like that when you grew up there?
It was a little bit rougher, like mid to early 90s. But yeah, it's always kind of had that sort of hip vibe. It's a little more like hipster now. But I think there's probably 10 more microbreweries than there was when I was a kid. But
and coffee shops.
Yeah, and coffee shops. But yeah, no, I grew up all over there going to like all the cool little shops around Knob Hill, and we were about 4 or 5 blocks, pretty much Washington and Central. So yeah, it was a cool area to grow up. And like I said, I spent most of my childhood kind of helping my dad with his pottery business and tinkering with stuff out in his studio. he rode motorcycles. He wasn't really mechanical at all, but he was really good with me, encouraging both the artistic side and the mechanical side. Like, he would, I don't know if it was just to stop me from taking his stuff apart or what, but he would take me to thrift stores and let me like pick out different electronics and gadgets and stuff, and then I'd sit around in his studio and take them apart and kind of figure out how they work or try to put them back together and make something else.
Yeah, I met his brother came into the shop. What was that, like about 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, they were here over Thanksgiving.
The one from New York.
Mm-hmm.
And his mom came in, and super nice family. And his brother right away had, I was talking about you, Jake, and his brother had mentioned that as a kid he remembers Jake taking apart everything, like constantly taking things apart and like trying to rewire things and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And was it just, you were just fascinated with everything that you saw, like and how it worked?
Yeah, I just wanted to be able to figure out how it worked, and especially if I could figure out how to make it do something else. Like, what parts can I kind of scavenge from one thing and put together with another and make something else? Like, I think when I was about 10, I had one of those scooters with bicycle wheels on it that was, you know, like a push scooter that you have bicycle wheels on. And then for $5, my neighbor sold me his weed whacker at a yard sale. So I was able to take that apart and then hook a chain to the rear wheel of my scooter. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I was only 10 years old, so it probably wasn't, like, it didn't have any brakes. And you couldn't, you couldn't start it and then go. You had to, like, lean it over to one side, pull the cord and start it, and then jump on. But
the wheel's spinning in the back and you got to get it.
Yeah. But it, yeah, I got it, you know, good enough to go down the road and bomb around the neighborhood on.
That's cool. Were you always, like, fascinated with motorcycles from your dad?
So I always really liked motorcycles. I think I was, by the time I was 5, I was riding around on my godfather's like Ninja, and then my dad had a probably late 70s XS 650 Yamaha.
Cool.
And we'd ride around on that. But then,
so those are all street bikes.
Yeah.
So they were riding street bikes. That's cool.
And then it was, for my dad's pottery business, every once in a while we'd do like a vacation slash, we'd basically load up a van with a bunch of his pottery and go to try to find galleries that would take his stuff. I think I must have been about 9 or 10, and we did like a trip out to California, and we were stuck in traffic. And I know, because I ended up living in California later, I know that we were on the San Bernardino freeway on the 15 South. And it was just like bumper to bumper, and this pack of Hell's Angels just comes splitting lanes by us, and it's like loud, and they've got their back patches on and stuff. And I just remember like the look of horror on my mom's face that like she couldn't believe they were riding in between the cars and had their like quote unquote gang insignia on the back. And then pretty much I was like, that's what I want to do with my life.
Lane splitting rockers on the back of your leather jacket.
Through LA traffic.
Through LA traffic.
So after that, I got super into like custom builds, or the idea of custom motorcycles, and just like anything I could do to like research it. And ended up getting, I think when I was like 15 or 16, my first bike I got after that, I bought a Suzuki RV90. Because I got my 100cc or less license. And I took my bar mitzvah money and I bought that. And learned to ride on that. And then I moved up to a CX500, 79 CX500. That was my first full-size bike. And then I also got a totally unreliable and didn't know what I was doing, but I bought a 63 Norton Chopper with like an extended girder front end.
Wow.
And no front brake.
So you bought that local?
Yeah.
Do you remember who it was from?
No.
Wow.
So you went from Japanese bikes, which were fairly reliable and you knew how to work on them, to getting a British bike that you had no clue.
With a girder front end.
But I had the CX500 and, in high school I had the CX500 and that Norton. The Norton was never that good of a bike for like riding around. I'm sure it was a great bike if somebody knew what they were doing, but I rode that around a little bit, and I had a 53 Plymouth Cranbrook. So I was always into old bikes and old cars and stuff. And that was, I mean, I was 15 or 16 spending everything I had on that stuff.
That's awesome, man. I wish we had more kids like that.
I know, right? What about your friends? Were your friends into bikes and cars too?
No, my friends were all punk rockers. You know, I kind of grew up in the Albuquerque punk scene here. Mm-hmm. They're all like punk kids.
So you were the only one that had like, you know, some mechanical know-how at
I was the only one working on bikes. I was the only one with my, I think a couple of my friends from high school ride now, but back then, no.
Do you remember what the motorcycle scene or the custom car scene was like in Albuquerque at that point? Because this is what, probably like early 90s?
No, this, now we're talking about right around 2000. Well, okay. Yeah, because I was born in 85, so I got my 100cc license in 98, and then I was riding full-size bikes by about 2000, 2001.
Wow.
It's not that long ago.
No.
You know, we're, I don't know, I'm an old guy, so to me that doesn't seem like that long ago, but I guess it is. It's like, what, 18 years now, right?
Yeah. I mean, and I think too, like in Albuquerque, I wasn't here at that point, but I mean, I can't imagine a whole lot of kids, you know, riding around in high school on bikes and old cars at that point.
Yeah, I don't remember a lot of bikes. There was a pretty big greaser scene. Like the 12-Step Rebels were like a huge band at that time. And I was part of a little collective that ran like an all-ages venue, and those guys played a lot. It was called Insurgo. I don't know if anybody remembers that. We were open for like 14 months. And
where was it at?
It was at Morningside and Central in like a little strip mall.
Yeah, I remember that. I was pretty active in the music scene between like 95 and 2003. And I remember, yeah, there was like a punk scene, a ska scene going on. There was a lot of, I remember 12-Step Rebels, there was like Beat Fetish and those bands, and they were all sort of punk ska.
Yeah, do you remember Giant Steps?
I do,
ska band?
Yeah.
Tom was my principal my first year of high school, the trumpet player.
Wait, no, I don't remember this.
Well, yeah. That's, I mean, it's cool.
So I was super into it, and I start buying like all the Chopper magazines I could. And I guess, I'm sure they look terrible because this is like pre-Photoshop. So I'm literally like buying Chopper magazines and taking scissors and cutting pictures of bikes apart and scotch taping them back together with like the parts that I think would look better on a certain, like this gas tank off of this bike, this front end off this bike, and all of these, and a lot of the magazines at that time, like 2001, 2002, there was a full black and white, a full page black and white ad for Exile Cycles, and the owner, Russell Mitchell, was just like this cool looking guy with like kind of a pompadour style mohawk, and like his crew there, and the bikes looked awesome. And as part of a school project, I was kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I was graduating a year early. I graduated when I was 17, and I didn't really want to go to college, at least not yet. And I really wanted to build bikes, and as part of a school project, I wrote him a letter saying, like, I love your bikes, you know, that's what I want to do with my life. Can I, you know, I'll come work for free if I have to and work a second job for money, like, just begged him for a job, basically. And I didn't hear anything back from him. And then me and my dad went to the Red River, New Mexico motorcycle rally. It's like, I think it's a Memorial Day run.
Right.
And Exile wasn't that popular then. And there was this photographer there that was doing a photo shoot with a bike, and he was wearing an Exile shirt. So I went and talked to him. And I said, oh, I noticed your shirt. Like, I've never really seen anybody wearing his shirts around or anything. I'm like a huge fan of his. I told him all about this letter I wrote to him. And he's like, oh, I've known Russell for years. I'll call him up for you. So he calls him up, and then, like, I think by the time we got back from that trip, I had a message on the machine, like, finish up, graduate high school, and I got a job waiting for you.
Wow.
Pay me, like, $10 an hour to pack boxes and run errands for them and that kind of stuff.
What did you think when you heard that message? Because I mean, I don't know. I'm a firm believer that if you can envision something and you really want something, somehow, some way, the planets align. And if you're a good enough person, I think that it works in your favor. So was that like an awe experience for you as soon as you got back and you heard that?
I mean, part of it was super excited and I really wanted to do it, but I was either 16, about to be 17 at that point. I was like, wow, that opportunity really came up. Now I gotta move to California by myself and, you know, figure all that stuff out. So, I mean, it was probably about, between the time I got that message and the time I was out there, it was probably about 6 or 8 months.
That's pretty quick.
That's quick. Yeah.
Gotta be careful what you ask for sometimes. Exactly. Sometimes you get it.
I mean, I think to Jake, that would be like some Ivy League kid wanting to go to Princeton and getting his acceptance letter, yeah. Right? It's the same exact thing.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, I just busted my ass that last few months of high school. I took welding classes at night, so I'd have some of those skills. Got a bunch of credit. This was like pre-online classes, so I literally did correspondence school and got my diploma a year early.
Did you do it so that you could get out there sooner? That's really cool, man.
Yeah, I knew there was no way my mom was going to let me go if I didn't graduate. Plus, I wasn't sure exactly what I was going to end up doing, but I knew that I needed to at least get the high school diploma and then college would be an option. I'd have more job options. I knew I wasn't ready for college right then, but.
So did you find a place to live, or did you have family, friends? What were you thinking?
My mom had an old friend that was there, and she said I could stay with her for a week while I looked for a place. I had a really hard time. I did find a place in that week's time. I had a hard time finding a place.
Where was his shop? Where's Exile at?
It's in LA. It's in Sun Valley in the San Fernando Valley. Okay. Well, it's not anymore, but that's where it was.
It was in the valley when you went out there?
Yeah. So I had a really hard time getting a place because I was 17. Nobody would let me sign a lease. So I ended up getting a roommate with this guy in just like this super slummy, like little white trash apartment.
Was it in the valley, or were you
in
LA?
Yeah, it was in the valley. Yeah, it was in Valley Village. Back when there used to still be a train track that ran through there. My apartment was like 20 yards from the train track there.
So did you drive or fly out there?
I rode my motorcycle.
Oh, wow. What bike were you on at this point?
At that time, I'd saved up and I bought a Honda Shadow.
What a perfect bike to ride. From New Mexico, actually, California, right?
Yeah. I actually didn't go straight to California. I took, because I graduated, when did the schools let out here? It's like
about
May.
May.
Right?
Yeah.
So I remember I started June 3rd there. So from, I took my last final exam, and then the next day I hopped on my bike, and I had like a newer reliable bike, and I was stoked on it. So instead of heading for California, because I had a few weeks, I headed for Texas. I rode around Texas and Oklahoma.
You know that's the different direction.
Yeah.
You took the long way.
Yeah. So, no, I put like 6 or 7,000 miles on that bike in whatever that period of time was between the end of high school and getting out there June 3rd. So I rode all over Texas and Oklahoma and then rode out to Los Angeles.
That's, you know, cool. What's funny is
I had 5 changes of clothes and an alarm clock in my saddlebag, and I think I'd saved... I worked in a little factory making clay here, a little clay factory. I saved up like $1,500.
Cool, man. That's a great, like, graduating from high school, sort of coming of age story. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Get a reliable bike, head out on the road right after graduation, just kind of see the country a little bit, and then go to California. Have you, from a musician standpoint, it'd be like getting on the bus and getting off, you know,
with
your guitar.
Looking like Axl Rose Welcome to the Jungle.
But you're on your bike. I mean, you'd been to LA a few times, obviously, right? So you kind of had an idea.
Well, I think I'd been there. I went there twice. I went there with my Maybe possibly three times. I'm sure I went a couple of times when I was really little because my brother went to UCLA. So we probably went to visit him. And then I know we went on that trip when we were selling my dad's pottery. And I went once with my Hebrew school.
So really, you weren't familiar with LA much when you moved out there. You kind of just showed up.
No, I wasn't. Somebody recommended I buy a Thomas guide because this was pre-GPS. Yeah. Anybody remembers Thomas guides? Or it's basically like a phone book sized map. So I stuck that in my saddlebag and figured it out.
A big, thick map, atlas map. That's awesome.
There were a couple times I got pretty lost. I remember I showed up. At this time I had like, because this is early 2000s, I had like a bomber jacket on with like an Iron Cross on my back and one of those stupid German helmets with a spike on it. I met some girl and she gave me directions to go to a party. I got totally lost and I'm like, where the hell am I? And I look up and I see a sign that says Compton Medical Supply. And I'm like, I'm out of here. Right? Yeah, it was quite an adventure,
man. You could have ended up at an NWA party.
You could have, hanging out with Eazy-E. Yeah. You know what's funny, though, is, and I was going to mention this, is that as soon as I graduated high school out of Taos, my buddy Dave and I, we both had bikes, and we decided just to hit the road, and we went all the way out to South Carolina on our bikes. Wow. I mean, you know, you pull like 12 or 14 hours when you're younger. But there was kind of like remember in high school, just being carefree, right? And just being like, okay, whatever happens, happens. And, you know, you have one sleeping bag and a couple pairs of clothes and that was it. And, you know, I think it's a good coming of age story because you don't really have to, you don't have bills, you know, you're just trying to go out and experience the world.
No worries, man.
Yeah, whatever happens, happens, you know. Yeah. I wish more kids would kind of do that.
Totally, man.
I mean, now it's a different day and age, but
it is.
You can still get it done, right? Yeah. A little bit of
it's just like you said, man, it's like there's something about that feeling that you just can just go sort of where the wind blows you a little bit, you know. Yeah. I mean, you had a job and it was kind of like a dream job for you at that time, I imagine, you know. It's like here's sort of your idol, you know, and then you can just show up, he's waiting for you, and you got like nothing to worry about for those 2 or 3 weeks that you're traveling out there, you know. That's like ideal.
It was great. And then I got out there, and the timing was just so perfect for me because, like I said, I mean, within the motorcycle industry, Russell was a name. Some people knew him, but if you weren't, like, totally into custom bikes, you probably never heard of him. And then within probably 5-6 months of me getting there, we did our first pilot TV show.
Wait, let me just stop you for a minute. So you get out there and you're introduced to Russell. You see the shop. What is he having you do at first?
I mean, I was pretty much like an all-around gopher. I was running parts around, you know, going to the powder coater, the painter, pretty much driving the van most of the time.
And was his crew, because he's from England, you watched the show, Steve.
Yeah.
Was his crew, because it looked like he had a couple other guys there that were British too, right?
Yeah, when I first started there, it was Russell and Danny were both British. And then there were a couple other British guys that cycled through there during the time I was there. But the actual crew that was in the shop was pretty small. It was me, Johnny Goodson, and then Dylan Zwicker. So Johnny was the head mechanic when I started, and then Dylan was doing the fabrication work.
And you were the shop kid.
Yeah,
I was the shop kid, yeah.
And how many years had that shop been up and running?
They were right around probably about 7 or 8 years, I think, when I started.
Not fairly, like, you know, they didn't have
Their 20th anniversary. So, yeah, they were probably about 8 years old, something like that.
When you got there. Yeah. And then how did the whole series thing come about?
So we did a series called Build or Bust. We actually shot the pilot for that first, and the premise of that show was basically you take a guy that's like into bikes, maybe knows how to work on stuff a little bit,
right?
And he's given the opportunity to build a custom bike, and he's got 30 days to build it, and with limited assistance from us, but the use of our shop.
And they gave him a budget, right? He had a certain amount of a budget?
Yeah. Sorta. I mean, a lot of the, I don't know about that part. I can't remember, but a lot of the parts came from sponsors and stuff.
So just to put it into perspective for time, what was that, about 5 years ago? Was that
longer than that?
This was 2004.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Wow.
So we do. I remember that show on Discovery Channel because they would get.
Well, that one was on Speed.
Oh, was it Speed? Yeah. Okay, because I Discovery or Speed, I can't really remember who shot it, but I do remember that they would get a lot of well-known builders. Right, to kind of
I think you're thinking of, we're thinking of two different shows here.
Okay.
I was going chronologically. So we shoot the pilot, and this show was never huge. We did do two seasons of it, but it was on Speed. And this is Build or Bust, where some stranger comes into the shop, they got 30 days to build a bike, and if they're successful with it, they get to keep the bike.
Right.
So it's a little competition game showy type thing.
2004, that's when.
This is about 2000, late 2003, early 2004, we do the pilot for that. And then we did Biker Build-Off, which is the one you're thinking of, and this was another competition type show. There were three seasons of it total, and on each episode of this show they would have two well-known builders build a bike each, and then they would have to go on a ride together to a bike rally, and the crowd at the bike rally would vote for your favorite, and whoever's the favorite, the crowd favorite wins. Basically.
Yeah. No, I think
and that's what really blew that shop up, and it also kind of provided me this huge opportunity to jump forward, because I've only been there at this point probably definitely under a year when we did our first biker build off, and Russell had an issue with the head mechanic, and he ended up leaving. And there was a bike that was ready to be assembled, and Russell left to go on the ride for the show and do this competition. And I didn't have very many gopher responsibilities, and I was like, whatever, I've been around this for 8 months, or, you know, I know which parts go where. So I put the bike back together, and it was running when he got back in town. And I was like, he's either going to be pissed or happy, we'll see. But he went and wrote it and said, okay, well, I guess I don't need to hire another head mechanic. So
no kidding.
Like 18, I became the mechanic there.
That's pretty cool. Awesome. So that first biker build off, that wasn't the one with Billy Lane, right? Who was the first one with?
I want to say the Billy Lane one was the number three, and I haven't looked at this stuff for a while. The first one, I think it was Arlen Ness.
Oh, yeah. And that was a big name in the chopper scene at that point.
Yeah, we did five of the biker build-offs total. I did three with Exile. I want to say one was Arlen Ness, one was Martin Brothers, and then one was Billy Lane. And then we also did a spin-off one that was called World Biker Build-Off, where it was, we actually played the English team, since Russell's from England. And then there was an American team from Texas, whose name leaves me at the moment, and then an Australian team. And then I also did an additional, I was a build team member for the biker build-off. I was on the Evil Spirit team, and that was up against Chica.
Oh, wow. He is a great builder, too, if you've ever seen him. Mm. He's Japanese,
right? Yeah, he's Japanese.
Yeah, that guy does some cool
stuff. Oh, yeah.
So this is like, and I'm thinking back, you know, in the motorcycle industry in the world, this is kind of the height of the chopper scene.
It was
right, because you have Indian Larry, you have Arlen Ness, you have Jesse James. I mean, you have all these guys that are just blowing these motorcycles up. It's huge.
We're all over TV. Like, money's rolling in like crazy.
They're spending $30,000, $40,000 a bike.
Our bike started at 50 at the time, and then we did trikes for 70.
Jeez.
And so I was doing, I think my best year there, I did 16 bikes
in a year,
start to finish. Yeah.
Wow. So with all that money coming in, and you guys are on TV, you're meeting all these big, you probably met all
probably
of them,
the
right?
Funnest part is, let's see, this is happening when I'm about from about 19 20 21. We're all over TV, and I'm getting paid to go to like a crap ton of biker rallies all over the country, flying in for a weekend and stuff with Russell. I mean, obviously I'm not the celebrity really, but I got to go along for the ride and party in different cities all over the country. At least once a month I was going to a biker rally somewhere.
Wow. So for the biker scene, he's like the, I mean, you're living the biker dream.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Right? You're like, I hate to say it like this, but almost like a bat boy, you know, playing for the A's or the Giants, but I mean,
making the team
and like living the dream. Was there any point of that when you're like, wow, this is too much, or like maybe I'm out of my element, or?
No, I mean, what happened, and it was a very amicable thing, but after I was there for about just under 5 years, the shot, and this is getting to be about 2000, well, maybe it was more like 4 years. This is getting to be about 2006, real early 2007. The shop had gone from about four guys to about 12 with an apparel business also built in that was a separate crew. And it was becoming a much more like structured, semi-corporate environment. He brought in a general manager that I didn't really get along with particularly well. And I just went to him and said, you know, this, you know, it's not the fun crew that we started out with, and it's time for me to go off on my own. And when I was 21, maybe almost 22, I opened up my shop in North Hollywood.
Did you feel like at that time, could you, I mean, I hate to say it like this, but that whole scene, right, that big chopper scene, the writing was kind of on the wall, you know, with all these, like Big Dog and all these other companies kind of coming in. And I hate to say it, with like Jesse James and the West Coast Choppers, you know, starting to like sell stuff at Walmart, it just became too big almost for itself. Did you kind of get that feeling that like, you know what, it's like almost enough is enough, and I want to get back to where your roots were?
That was still kind of early though, because it was 2000.
Well, no, I mean, the chopper thing crashed with the housing market. And my shop officially opened doors in August of 2007. Yeah. So you can kind of imagine, I was like, I probably wouldn't have done it right then, but it was still an awesome experience for me. I mean, I was in LA, so there's a lot of like other types of money, you know, like quasi celebrities and actors and stuff that had money. And I ended up doing a lot of different fab type projects. Like I got into building some gates and railing for people's homes. I started doing a little bit of art department stuff, like building some props stuff. And at this point, I'm living in an 84-person Bluebird school bus. It was a band tour bus on this property we called the Compound. It was like fluctuating between like 8 and 12 kind of artist-type people living on a property in North Hollywood, and my shop's two blocks away. The only way I could afford to have my shop is that I was paying $200 a month to sleep in this school bus that's parked there. And then my shop's another $2,000 a month or something like that.
Why didn't you just live in your shop?
My shop was tiny, and there was no room for like a shower or any of that stuff. And plus the Compound was so much fun.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you were more in your element going back to that?
It was good. Yeah, I mean, I got to know a lot of really cool people. I mean, I've got a lot of customers from that time that I'm still good friends with now. And it was really cool. I kept that shop going from August of 2007 through 2012. And I got to work on a lot of exciting projects. During the recession, it got to the point where I was doing a lot more repairs than I wanted to do just to stay afloat. And I didn't really want to be running a repair shop. And I kind of started thinking about different things, and I started taking community college classes at night, and finally ended up deciding, well, through traveling around with Exile and everything, I'd met this girl in Minnesota, and we'd stayed in touch for like 5 years. And I was kind of feeling down, and like went to visit her. And I was at the point with my community college classes that if I wanted a degree, it was time to transfer to a four-year school. So she had several days off work. I went and stayed with her. And then she had to work one of the days that I was there. And I was like, well, I'll go check out the college campus. I went, like, got an official tour or whatever. And they offered me an awesome scholarship if I wanted to go there, because I had a 4.0 at the community college. So That was, yeah, so then summer 2012, I ended up moving up to St. Cloud, Minnesota. We moved in together, and I enrolled in school and set up a home shop in the basement of our rent house. So, like, I mean, Minnesota winters are brutal, so I'd build custom bikes. I'd do all the fab work and stuff downstairs, like in the basement, and then we had like a really tiny garage. So basically it was like, before winter gets here, buy an old bike, take it all apart, carry all the parts down to the basement, do all the fab and paint work in the basement, and then by the time the world's starting to thaw out, move it out to the garage and put it back together again and sell it. And I started working at this really cool shop that was like, they specialized in vintage British bikes, but kind of did a lot of everything else too, called Zap Leather and Cycle. Really cool guy. I think he's almost 70 years old, this guy Chuck, and he's got like 3 or 4 storage units, his mom's garage, his chicken coop, and a huge shop just full of vintage bikes that are like...
That's a guy I want to meet.
Yeah, that's where I want to go.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like, a lot of times it's not like, oh, can we get something ordered in? It's like, we need this part. Oh, I think I got one in the back of the chicken coop. Go take it off of that Triumph and see if it fits, you know? And it was cool, man.
Was
and
it he, just you two?
No, it was, he had a regular repair shop. I was like the guy that came in to do fab work and custom builds. And it was a little bit of a trek for me. It was about 30 miles away from where I was living. And he was super cool with me. He would let me just clock in from home. Like, I could bring like a gas tank or a frame or whatever that I was working on home. So sometimes I could clock in every day and just work out of my basement for like a week at a time, not have to fight the snow and stuff like that. He was super cool to me.
What was his name?
Chuck Koschel, Zap Leather and Cycle in Painesville, Minnesota.
Is he still there?
Oh yeah. He actually came and visited me about a week ago.
That's awesome.
Driving through town. Sweet, man.
Yeah.
That's cool.
He bought a Triumph from me.
That's cool.
Well, let's take it back to LA real quick.
Okay.
One of the things that, you know, I think is really interesting, because I work in the film industry and Hollywood's, you know, like a famous star in the film industry. So,
is it famous or infamous?
A little bit of both, actually.
Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to. Yeah, I don't want to be anywhere in front of the camera these days.
Tell us about the build-offs, man, because I know the question that everybody always asks is, how staged is it? You know what I mean? Because it is, for the most part, right?
The Discovery biker build-offs were produced by Hugh King. Those were very not staged. The only thing which you could call Hollywood magic at all would be the filming process a little bit. They make it look like you're both building on a deadline at the exact same time, but it's the same crew. Like, they set up the same crew to shoot both shops. So they'd switch back and forth, a week here, a week there, a week there. But the timelines and everything they laid out were pretty dead on. And those crews were like super good about not doing the like, oh, can you say that again? Can you walk in with the part this way? They were very like, it was filmed what I would call pretty documentary style. I mean, they did a pretty good job. The Builder Bus Show was like completely staged.
Yeah.
I mean, the competition existed, but the producer was constantly manipulating things. There were a lot of like do-overs. Like,
did that bother you?
No. Not at all.
Yeah,
because I loved being on TV, and like, I it was so much fun.
Yeah, I'm going to bring this up because I'm sure you saw this too, Steve. But that the biker build-off, it was funny because there Russell Mitchell tells Jake to pick up the motor, right? Remember that? And, and you're like, kind of like this young, kind of like skinny kid with the blue mohawk. And you got like your kind of punk pants on. And they're like, oh, have Jake pick up the motor. And I was like, dude, he's like the smallest guy there. And they're like, oh yeah, this little guy, he's like, one of the mechanics is like, oh, he's small, but he's a strong kid, strong lad. And he picks up that motor and you drag it over to the bike. And I was like, wow, man, like he was doing it all. It was cool to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I carried a 96 S&S down from a 2-floor apartment by myself once.
Wow. But it didn't look like, I mean, there wasn't like any, I think with that crew, with Russell Mitchell and you guys, it didn't look like you guys were trying to play the part. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah. You were just kind of like naturally doing what you're doing.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a fun time. We all really liked each other.
I think that makes me feel better to hear that it was pretty legit from the standpoint of building the bikes, because I think later on when you get to like the West Coast chopper and the Orange County choppers, you know, those things, you can tell they're so.
A lot of people used to talk shit about Jesse James, but I've always thought he was like super talented guy. I mean, some of his work is just incredible, man.
Yeah.
But I mean, Monster Garage, that was the cheesiest show that's ever been on television. Maybe Orange County Choppers was worse, but yeah, some of those shows were obviously just totally faked for television and very staged drama
And I hate to say it, I mean, I know you'd mentioned the recession had kind of killed that scene, but I think, and maybe this is just my humble opinion, but I think part of the scene just got too big and it got too staged. You know what I mean? And it became less about the, like the build off that you guys did. The bikes that you guys had built, they were rideable, right? They looked like bikes that you could ride around town, which I thought was great. And I thought at certain points, some of these choppers that these guys were building, I wouldn't want to ride that. And I don't know if anybody, like, if you could ride it down the block.
Right.
You know, and I feel like almost got to be too big for what it was supposed to be.
Well, the episode that you and I were talking about with Jake, where when he had the
Mohawk.
When he was picking up the motor and he had the blue punk rock Mohawk, was the build off with against Billy Lane, right?
Right.
And that bike that you guys built was, even today, would be really cool to ride. It had the carbon fiber tank. It was more like you said, like a
brat bike.
And I think Russell even said it at one point, right? Didn't he say we're going for kind of a rat style or something?
He probably would have said brat, but yeah.
It was really cool.
His bikes have a very industrial look. That one wouldn't be what I would call the classic Exile style as much, but that bike rode fantastic. Had a big 120 cubic inch motor. It was super lightweight with all the carbon fiber wheels, tank, fenders. It was built off of a FXR chassis, so it handled awesome. I think we had a Storrs front end. I don't remember what shocks we had in the rear, but it was great. And I think I was telling Tyson earlier, man, like first gear, drop the clutch, and that front end would just pick right up. You could ride a wheelie on it like it was a sport bike. I mean, I've ridden a bunch of Ducatis and stuff like that, and as far as the first gear wheelie, that one pulled up just as easy.
I really liked it. It, you know, it just seemed like a bike right now that would be cool to have.
Exactly. Yeah.
So did you see the vintage scene start coming around while you were there? I mean, did it start coming around while you were still there?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I can't ever remember a time where like an old Triumph or an old Knucklehead or Shovelhead wasn't cool.
Yeah, I mean, for sure.
I think part of what happened, I mean, this is my perspective on what happened. You had these bikes that were being built for more money than they should have been built for. But, I mean, all these little shops that, you know, they get on TV once and they charge 50 or 60 grand for a bike, who's going to not do that? But then, you know, you have people that were getting credit way too easy. All of a sudden, they're underwater when the housing bubble burst, and they start, all of a sudden, these $70,000 bikes are flooding the market. They're all, you could see all over eBay, these bikes that people had spent, you know, 50, 60, 70 grand on, they're going for maybe 20, 15, and it's just, you know, part of that is, well, they were probably worth 30, you know what I mean? They were probably worth 30 or 35, so they got charged for way too much. And then all of a sudden, people are selling them at the same time, and nobody has any money. So that kind of dropped it off. But I mean, of course, people are still going to love riding.
Right.
So then, you know, it sort of started becoming cool to pick up like a ratty old bike and, you know, spend, you know, maybe 10 grand on it or something.
How did you feel about that when the crash hit and everything kind of started taking a dive? I mean, did you, because when I see Jake come into the shop, one of the most talented dudes I know, but like super reserved and humble, you know, like you'll just, when you come in and you do some pinstriping, just kind of do your thing. And, you know, there's nothing showy about you. So did you feel like you went kind of more back into your element when when that whole thing kind of popped and you just wanted to go back to building on your own or even in Minnesota? Did that feel better?
Yeah, like, I mean, I spent so much of my life inside of a workshop, and it's, I love that. And look, I dig the, I guess, rattier looking bikes. I mean, I ride a old FXR now, and it's all raw metal, and it's cool. I mean, I dig that stuff. It's not the greatest thing for business that people, for me, that people aren't spending that kind of money on motorcycles, but, you know, motorcycles gave me a lot of skill set, and I've kind of broken off into doing other things, you know, from that skill set. So, I don't know if I can say I'm back in my element, especially because, you know, the first time I was getting paid to work on bikes was at Russell's shop, so building these super expensive bikes. But, I mean, I'm saying this because it's kind of funny, but when I was 17, like, the first bike I was on the clock and got to turn a wrench on was George Clooney's.
That's cool.
I didn't build the whole bike, but I was helping out Johnny, and he had me tighten up part of the primary or something for him. So it was the first time I picked up tools and put them on a bike for money. It was George Clooney's bike. So it sounds false for me to say I was back in my element, but yeah, me, I'm total, you know, punk rocker. I like the rat rods and rat bikes and that kind of stuff. And I think you have a little bit more creative license with that style bike, and I love that kind of stuff. But, you know, if people were going to go on spending 70 grand a bike forever, I gladly would have taken it and built shiny bikes.
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, it's amazing when you do something that you enjoy doing, and then it becomes successful, and then you can make money on it. It's hard to say anything bad about that, right? Because it's paying the bills, and it's helping you achieve the things that you enjoy doing. So you can't really knock that stuff.
Yeah.
But you coming from a background of being loving fabricating, and you're an awesome pinstriper. You do amazing pinstripe work. You can turn a wrench. You know, you can do all that stuff. Which part of that is kind of your favorite part? Do you have a favorite, or does it all just kind of come together?
I like
for
doing
you?
Different stuff. I mean, the painting and pinstriping is really fun. Pinstriping was supposed to be a hobby, but that didn't really work out. Now I'm doing it all the time for people. The painting and pinstriping just came out of coming from Southern California, where there's like so many amazing painters and pinstripers. I got to know this guy Scratch out there. That's like,
yeah,
he just blows me away, man. Like, just can the stuff he can do with a brush is just incredible.
He does all the rat rod stuff, and he's all over TV.
He's a car builder too, but yeah, his pinstriping is really cool. I kind of became buddies with him, and I'd have him do a lot of my paint work. There's just so many really good, talented painters out there that I'd never even, like, it never even crossed my mind to paint a bike I'm building. Like, okay, I'll pay this amazing guy to do it. And then I get up to Minnesota, and the first bike or two I built, I was like looking around at painters, and I was like, I'm not paying for this. So I just watched YouTube videos until I figured it out, and then I kind of got good at it. And you know, then it kind of became like, okay, well, I painted this gas tank, and I really want to have a Harley logo on it and a little bit of pinstriping, so I better buy a pinstriping brush. And then I bought a vinyl plotter so I could do logos easy and make my own stencils. And so it just kind of became like, all right, I'm just going to figure out how to do it myself, because, yeah, I mean, there just wasn't that center of talent up there.
Yeah. Plus, and it's super fulfilling, right, to be able to do so much of the build yourself, from the fabrication to the mechanics to the painting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great feeling, you know. As limited as I am at some of that stuff, it still feels good when I can accomplish something, you know.
The town I was living in was like, it's basically two little towns squashed together that made about 60,000 people when college was in session. And so, you know, we had like a powder coater and a metal store and that kind of stuff. And I ended up with a crew of like probably 12 guys that I got to know fairly well. Like, this guy Ryan Shep runs a really cool tattoo shop there, and he's super into like Hayabusas and that kind of stuff. Like, he's just all about going fast. And
yeah.
And then there was the guy that I got to know that ran the powder coating shop. He did a lot of custom builds. He had a pretty cool, like, old school Triumph and a couple of, like, CB750 choppers. And actually, the shop I was doing work for out there, we did a lot of cafe racers.
Wow. So that's when...
Norton Fastbacks.
What year was this? Like, 2016?
So I got to... Yeah, so I worked with Zap from 2013 to 2016.
And I'm sure at this point you're starting to see... Now you're starting to see the cafe stuff kind of come in, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was big then, but we were doing... that was pretty much the main thing. I built two... like custom kind of bobbers while I was there. Other than that, it was all cafe racing.
Because you'd built that CB750, which was blue and red. Was that up there?
Yeah. Well, I built that in my basement.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That one, I built that one when I went and bought that bike when I found out Kaylee was pregnant. Built it that winter, sold it when he was born, and sent her with cash to pay off his bills.
Oh, wow.
So, paid for all.
He was paid for with a motorcycle. Yeah.
The CB750. Yeah. Way nice. To go, Honda.
That's a great story.
Yeah. Were you missing New Mexico up there?
I was, yeah. My mom's still here. My dad died while I was up there. But my mom's still here. And we'd come to visit and stuff like that. And I was just, man, the thing that really killed it for me was the weather and the food. And New Mexico's got awesome food and awesome weather.
That's right.
And my mom's getting to be in her 70s, and she's still on her own and doing awesome. But it's nice to be able to, like, be here and, like, run over and set up her air conditioner for her and, like, just have her be around her grandson and that kind of stuff. And it's been good for me. I was in Minnesota till 2016. I got my college degree, and then we wanted to build a house. Kaylee liked Albuquerque quite a bit from visiting and stuff like that, and I was just kind of like, let's move somewhere warmer. And she said, we can move to Albuquerque. And I said, great, let's do it, my mom will love it. And then we came, like, kind of did like a little bit of scouting, started looking at houses because we'd been renting, we wanted to buy a house. And we went and met with a mortgage broker, and I'd been self-employed since 2007 at this point. I mean, even though I worked with Zap, I was a private contractor there. Like I said, I'd work out of my shop half the time, his shop half the time. And the mortgage broker said, if you're self-employed and filing that way, you have to be established in New Mexico for 2 years to get a mortgage, or I need two pay stubs. So I was like, all right, cool, I'll go find a job. And turned out a shop called PJ's was hiring, and they were really nice. I met PJ. He wasn't really around that much when I started there. I started there in like early February of 2017, and they were a Triumph dealership, and they'd gone through, when I'd gotten there, they had been a Ducati dealership and a Triumph dealership. And when I got there, I came over to take over as the lead technician for Triumph, and Ducati moved out, and then it was PJ's wife running the business. And I did really well there. It was the first time I'd worked as a flat rate mechanic, which means you get paid by the, I mean, I guess kind of when I'm self-employed I'm flat rate, but for a shop, you know, you get paid by how quick and correctly you can get it done. As long as you can get it done fast and it doesn't come back to you, you can make some good money. And so I got good pay stubs, and we bought a house here in town. But unfortunately, the business couldn't go through growing pains, and they shut down about 6 or 8 months after I'd started there.
Yeah,
it's kind of weird, because that's actually when I met you. I met you at PJ's, and we were going in to talk to PJ's wife about doing a web series, or not a web series, a TV series about building bikes for veterans.
Right.
And you were there, and that's when I met you, and we knew that you had done some, you had some history doing some reality show.
Yeah, I remember.
Motorcycle building and stuff, and that was pretty cool. And then, yeah, everything kind of fell apart before anything could materialize. But, yeah, it's kind of interesting how people's paths cross, and it's kind of cool that you've come full circle, man. You know, it's like you started here as a kid and had this dream of doing motorcycles, and you went and you kind of lived your dream in California, ended up going to Minnesota and getting your degree, and then you kind of come back and you have a son. Yeah. And you're kind of back here. What's next for you?
I mean, I'm building a lot of cool stuff at home. For about a year now, I've been restoring classic cars for a day job. I do that part-time, 3 or 4 days a week at a shop called Old Car Garage. They do a lot of high-end restorations, and I do the fabrication end of that. Really cool. I wish it was a little bit more custom. It's mostly restorations, but a lot of English wheel work and metal shaping work. So that's kind of fun. And then I build motorcycles at home, and I got a 51 Ford that I'm trying to get to that's at my house. And I do a lot of art stuff. Keeping going with that. And I'm excited about the growing film industry here, and I'm hoping to get back to doing some props and doing a little bit of work with that kind of stuff. I've tried to keep that going a little bit. I've done like last year I did some pinstriped baseball bats for Amazing Race, and that was pretty cool. They saw my stuff on Instagram and ordered them so that they could break them over some electronics on TV.
Nice.
I might know a guy that can kind of help you get into that industry, hopefully.
I'm trying.
Right, Steve?
I'm trying to get him on a show now.
But a guy like Jake, I mean, he could get in anywhere.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, you're so talented, man. Seriously. And I'm not just saying that because we know you and stuff. I mean, super talented. And
I'm sure you're just saying it because you need a good deal on some pinstriping.
I do. I got two tanks. Yeah. You know, honestly, though, one thing that Tyson and I have always talked about from the beginning is you are successful when you help your friends be successful.
That's
right.
And
the more that you can help each other out, it comes back around. And I'm not just talking monetarily. I'm talking about, you know, just it's helping each other be successful, you know, emotionally and, you know, just in life, just being happy. And, you know, and we've always helped each other along the way. And Tyson and I have, you know, accomplished a lot of cool things because of that. And, you know, I'll help.
Just look at this coffee shop,
exactly.
Man. It's packed all the time. You know, there's always, it's like a constant flow of people. And it's because, you know, Tyson's got a bunch of friends. They're all telling everybody, like, go over here, check it out. I'm always telling people to come check this place out because it's cool people. And, you know, you want to help your friend's business be successful.
Exactly. The vibe's right.
Yeah, yeah.
So Made by Jake is the business, right? Is that, what's the website?
Madebyjake.org. And you can find there's links to Facebook and Instagram. You're welcome to add me, message me, whatever. It's even got my cell phone number and email and all that stuff's on the website. So just check out madebyjake.org and you can find pretty much any way to get in contact with me. I definitely keep my social media way more updated than my website. I probably update my website once a year, but I'm pretty active on social media. I sell a lot of my art and stuff through there too.
Can you get to your social media through the website?
Yep, you just click on the little Facebook or Instagram icons down at the bottom of the page.
Yeah, and you know, everybody that buys something from Jake, they're always really cool people too. And there's like the last couple of big pieces he sold. One of them was Scott, who rides the BMW. Scott, he has a pizza nights and stuff at his house.
Scott Cloninger?
No, Gawkin.
Oh, Scott.
Yeah, Scott bought he bought his bench off of him.
Very cool.
You know, everybody that buys Jake's stuff, they're really happy, and nobody ever really haggles over the price because, you know, it's cool artwork that's affordable, you know, and it's one-off stuff, like I mentioned.
Yeah, it's great.
It's totally worth it.
Yeah, I try to be pretty reasonable in my pricing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as an artist, you dictate, really.
Yeah.
Right? What people are willing to buy. And talk a little bit about your son really quick before we head out, because he's a cool little kid, man. Dylan's cool.
Awesome, man. He's getting out in the shop with me a lot. He can TIG weld a little bit already. He's four.
He's four?
Last Christmas, he got his first welding helmet. I custom painted a welding helmet for him for his Christmas present. He goes in spurts. I mean, he's four, so he doesn't have the greatest attention span, but he'll come hang out in the garage and, like, literally just, we'll put our welding masks on and he'll just get two pieces of metal to stick together, and he's, you know, we'll do that for a half hour. He's stoked. And what can I say, man? He's my little buddy. We have so much fun. Like, we do a hike almost every weekend in the foothills around Albuquerque. We go over to UNM campus and feed the ducks at the duck pond. And he's a cool kid, man. He's a really good person too. He's real friendly to everybody he meets. He's like, he doesn't know there's any evil in the world. He wants to be friends with everybody.
Yeah, it's that's super cool, rad. He's a great dad, by the way. Jake's an awesome dad.
You know, I just a little shout out to my dad. My dad was a welder, you know, growing up, and some of my best memories are like watching my dad weld and him teaching me, you know, some things. We built an old Firebird together, a 71 Firebird, and he had to weld a bunch of stuff, and he was always making something, trailers or, you know, just something out of metal. So I can respect that, and I appreciate that, and I think it's awesome that you're teaching your son that, because that's something he's totally going to remember, man, and you're teaching him something that's like, there's nothing like making something with your hands, as you guys both know, you know?
Yeah.
There's just nothing like it.
And especially with your dad.
Yeah.
You know, as like, I'm sure you're his hero, and you're probably his superhero, and, you know, he'll remember those things
totally.
For sure, forever.
Well, thanks, man. We really appreciate you coming and hanging out. I mean, I know
fun.
We see you a lot, but it was great to sit down and talk to you on the podcast and let people hear what you're doing, and hopefully they'll go check out your stuff. They need to go check out your stuff. And,
yep, madebyjake.org, and usually there's something available for sale over at Rust is Gold, too.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. We've got a couple of really killer podcasts coming up. Chris couldn't make it tonight. He was working, so hey, Chris, wherever you're at, you get to listen to the podcast like everybody else.
He's probably shocking himself somewhere, right?
Probably.
Messing with
the
wires.
Field somewhere. Yeah. And visit us at rustisgoldracing.com. We've got a lot of great things over there on the website. We'll have some pictures of Jake's stuff. We'll have some links to Jake's website. We've got shirts and mugs and all kinds of cool things that we've got, some new stuff. And we'd love for you to go check it out. Support the podcast. That's how we can afford to keep doing this. And you can check out our Patreon site as well. Come into the coffee shop. Say hey to Tyson.
Say hi to Jake. Jake on Sundays.
On Sundays. And we'll see you next time. Ride safe.
Down the way, not too far, an old-time rockabilly coffee bar. Record machine tucked in the back, Elvis singing about a Cadillac. I'm on a BSA, been riding all day. Leather's on, goggles too, triumphing, I don't know what you wanna do. My baby's on a Vincent, has been for quite a while. She said it's rocking just her style.
So let's ride,
so let's ride,
so let's ride.
Turn up, I got love the Kims. American rocker is a matter of fact.